You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 14th to the 20th of December 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Ellie Bothwell, news editor Chris Havergal and data editor Simon Baker. 2017 will, for many, be remembered as the year when Vice-Chancellor's pay levels went from being a grievance for staff in the higher education sector to a full-blown national scandal. The past week or so has seen no let-up in the torrent of stories about salaries, bonuses and golden goodbyes. Times Higher Education has been front and centre, uncovering details of the quite frankly eye-watering sums of money being received by those at the top of university management. Our lead news story this week hears from several former vice-chancellors who are breaking rank to criticise those currently in the job. We'll hear more on that in a moment. But elsewhere in the magazine this week, Simon has been looking into the seemingly relentless rise up the world university rankings of higher education institutions in East Asia. What do universities in China, Korea, Singapore and Hong Kong have in common? And can it explain their university's upward trajectory? But first, VC pay, Chris. It's been quite a couple of weeks, really, for what has been, in many ways, the scandal of the summer and now the winter too.
Yeah, I mean, as you rightly say, it's been quite a few months on the VC pay issue. The reason why the sort of frenzy is heightening now is that it's the time of year when universities are publishing their accounts, so their pay packages for 2016-17, last academic year, are emerging. There's been a couple of particularly striking examples of very large payoffs to departing vice-chancellors, which THE has reported over the last week or two. Many people will be aware of the case of Christina Slade, the former VC at Bath Spa, mm-hmm. who was paid £808,000 in her final year in the job. That included £429,000 as compensation for loss of office. There was also the case of Michael Farthing, the former Sussex Vice-Chancellor, who received £230,000 in lieu of notice. This all sort of culminated in a meeting yesterday between Joe Johnson, the university's minister, with representatives of the likes of Universities UK and the Russell Group, where the minister was very forthright, unusually sort of forthright in terms of the relationship between ministers and institutional autonomy, in terms of what he expected a new code, a new sort of guidance on executive pay being produced by the Committee of University Chairs to include. Mm. What our story, the lead story in this week's magazine, does is take a look at what that code, the CUC code, is actually likely to include. There's the full draft will be published early next month, but there's already some signs about the sort of stuff it's going to cover, in particular recommending that vice-chancellors step down from the remuneration committees yeah. that set their salaries. I mean, they say they leave the room when their own salaries are discussed, but I think a lot of people feel there should be a bit more separation than that. That chairs of university governing bodies aren't the people on the remuneration committees who are setting the vice-chancellor's pay. Typically in institutions, chairs of governing bodies and vice-chancellors will have to work together very closely by the nature of their roles. Mm. So again, there's a sort of a question of transparency and openness there. And also the code is likely, we understand, to advocate the use of pay multiples in setting vice-chancellor salaries, comparing the salary of the vice-chancellor to the average salary of the workforce, and suggesting that if you find yourself towards the very top on a sector-wide basis, you should be really thinking about how those payments can be justified.
Indeed, yeah, a couple of points on the things you've raised there. First of all, on those sort of comparisons between VC pay and average staff pay. Actually, Simon, you did some work a couple of weeks ago and we published online quite comprehensive information about UK universities and how the average pay in those institutions does compare to VC. So do make sure you check that out. And also, on the code, there's quite a bit of work to do. In fact, we have Stuart Farquhar writing online this week. He's a senior lecturer in economics and finance at Wolverhampton University. And he points to some of the things that you've alluded to there, saying a lack of transparency on pay discussions, the fact that VCs often sit on remuneration committees. All of this would mean that many universities would actually fail corporate governance tests, as currently sort of laid out in the corporate governance code. So quite a bit of ground to be made up maybe in the processes that universities get.
Yeah, but I mean, it is also worth sort of highlighting the sort of ground that the code it seems very unlikely that it will cover in terms of things like a cap on university vice-chancellor pay, a call for a pay freeze, comparisons to the Prime Minister's salary, the sorts of things that campaigners, the likes of Andrew Adonis, have been calling for.
Well, he said chop their pay in half.
Well, this guidance is not going anywhere near that. So there's no suggestion that it is going to solve this as an issue. But what it does look to do is to sort of improve the transparency, the understanding and the justification for these sorts of salaries, that clearly very considerable salaries that people are paid.
Mm, and then, Ellie, to have your say on this a little, it's not just the likes of Adonis and indeed the other media commentators we've heard about who are being critical. This week, for the cover story, or the main news story, you've been speaking to some former VCs and they've had their two penned as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see how some of the comments from former vice-chancellors kind of contrast with those currently in the job. So we spoke to Peter Knight, former vice-chancellor, who said that the pay increases are difficult to justify and have caused significant damage to the reputation of universities. In particular, he highlighted the fact that remuneration committees use of data from comparable institutions, why he said that was reasonable. He said that actually often it means that they choose to set pay above average, kind of close to the upper quartile, and that was an issue. Another kind of former vice chancellor I spoke to, who wanted to be anonymous, said that senior salaries were much too high. He said it sends completely the wrong message to their own staff. It undermines their credibility when it comes to standing up for universities. Mm. But there were some, current vice-chancellors that seemed to think, that it really wasn't that much of an issue. So,
storming a teacup.
Yeah, well, I spoke to Nick Petford, who's VC at the University of Northampton. He said he thought the row would blow over. He said it was absolutely not a crisis. He said it was an opportunity for universities to look at governance. But he said that, institutions shouldn't become too obsessed with the issue. He said, the danger for universities in trying to defend with journalists and politicians who are driving this, not the general public, is that it will detract from the great successes that UK universities actually are, which is sort of an interesting argument because you'd think that, surely you'd have to kind of debate it to a certain degree in order to kind of save the reputation of universities, but there are others who also made similar comments to him.
Indeed, I don't think there's anyone saying we shouldn't be celebrating the good work our universities do. Also, when journalists and politicians get involved with issues, it does tend to mean there is something there to be looked at as well. However, you can read all of those words on page 6 and 7 in THE. Obviously, it's all on timeshighereducation.com as well. I'll point out our cover feature this week is about editing academic journals. It's an important and prestigious task, but also time-consuming, exacting and frustrating. Our feature this week asks 8 current and former editors to advise those thinking of following in their footsteps on how to keep all of those balls in the air. It's a fascinating read. But Simon, over to you and back to the news section. You've been looking at the East Asian picture. Every year the World University Rankings come out, we see rises for institutions in the Far East. You've been trying to put some data behind why that might be and the similarities that some of those countries might exhibit.
It's a kind of a well-worn theme, isn't it? The rise of Asian universities in the rankings is kind of something which has become a little bit of a repetitive kind of refrain when it comes to looking at sort of world higher education. But what's interesting, if you look at the kind of data that we have in the rankings on institutions in that part, well, not the ones that are kind of in the top 100, but the ones kind of pushing sort of further down the list, is that you really see that Asian nations and universities, I mean, that's probably the issue with this debate, is it's kind of seen as one, it's all seen as the same, and which is probably not the way to kind of view it, because different countries are very different in Asia, obviously, and institutions' approaches to actually improving are very different. If you look at China and sort of South Korea, for instance, and you look at the data, a lot of their rankings position and their success is driven by just huge amounts of money going into those universities. In South Korea, particularly from industry. If you look at countries like Hong Kong, Singapore, the small, these small sort of like nation or city states that kind of have very successful universities, it's much more about their openness to the rest of the world, their collaboration with academics in other countries, and just the kind of cross-border flow of academics and students. So, and this kind of Asian Challenges group, which is basically a group of universities in the rankings that are quite similar, really shows this, because if you look at their kind of how they do on the part of the ranking that looks at internationalisation, so how well they co-author with academics in other countries, how many staff and students there are from other countries in those universities, you see that this group does not sort of perform very well on those kind of measures, because they're predominantly from kind of China, South Korea and those kind of countries. Hong Kong and Singapore aren't represented here because their universities are actually kind of right up the top of the rankings. And then if you sort of delve into kind of some of the data there is on collaboration, you sort of see that Hong Kong and Singapore, I mean, the percentage of research that they do that's actually got features international co-authorship is way, way higher than some of those other countries. And it kind of suggests that, I mean, it's part, kind of an obvious point, I suppose, because Hong Kong, Singapore are small places, then of course they're going to collaborate more than somewhere like China and even the United States.
Well, exactly,
much lower,
USA always has a very low international collaboration.
And Europe is much higher because, you know, European countries collaborate a lot more. But it just shows that if those institutions really want to kind of compete with and get to the top of the rankings, especially in China, to sort of push that bit further, then international collaboration is where they got a crack.
Indeed. And you've drawn together a sort of top 10 Asian challenges as part of this piece, and based on a sort of world university ranking position. Is that right?
Well, there's the Asian challenges is one of these clusters analysis that we're doing, which the data team have put together, and they've pulled together, there's probably about 60-odd universities in this kind of grouping. Mm. But, we've published the sort of top 10 according to where they're ranked in the world university rankings. Mm. So, they tend to be under the top 200, really, this group. But it's notable how they score very well on income measures and the amount of money that come from industry and that sort of thing, but don't do so well on collaboration and other internationalisation.
Indeed. Well, you can read all of that analysis on page 18 and 19 on timeshighereducation.com as well. Also, if you go to the blog section, we recently had the Higher Education Academy. They've been looking at our rankings from a teaching perspective. There's some interesting analysis on there of what happens if you take out all the research measures and rearrange our rankings by teaching criteria. It's also actually good news for Taiwan, Japan and China as well, but you can see that online. Just search at timeshighereducation.com. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything that we've discussed, you can do so on our site. You'll also find us on LinkedIn, on Twitter and on Facebook too. Just search on there. And that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.